Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, bipartisanship and free trade are two of corporate media's favorite things. So when the Washington Post editorial expressed the media consensus, now that Republicans have gained control of Congress, no policy area is riper for bipartisan action than trade, well, you can believe they were happy to do it. But should we be happy? And is it even true? We'll hear from Lori Wallach of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Also this week, Republicans have been hard at work for the past few years restricting the right to vote. Did their work pay off in the midterms? We'll speak to reporter Ari Berman, who's been following that story very closely and who recently wrote that it's become easier to buy an election and harder to vote in one. All of that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
The most glaring problem with corporate media's coverage of Ebola has been the overwhelming focus on the threat to the United States. So it was refreshing to see 60 Minutes correspondent Lara Logan head to Liberia, to the scene of the actual crisis. Her November 9th report was dramatic and quite moving. There was just one problem. They went all the way to Liberia, but didn't let any Liberians speak. No, CBS was focused on the American medical workers at one clinic. There's no doubt they are a brave and dedicated bunch, but foregrounding the American workers meant relegating Liberians to the background. This passage on 60 Minutes really says it all.
Most of the staff here are Liberian, and to lift their spirits, they mark every new shift with hymns. The stigma of the disease is so great, many of them say they're treated as outcasts when they commute back home every day. But in here, the Americans who work with them call them heroes.
So most of the healthcare workers are Liberians, and the Americans consider them heroes, but CBS didn't think to include them in their report. Instead, they are shown singing and dancing. Logan shows Liberian workers suiting up for duty and then asks an American doctor to describe how hard it is to work in that protective suit. Former New York Times reporter Howard French was one of the most vocal critics of this 60 Minutes piece. As he put it, "It's the erasure of Africans from history, in this case, their own history, and to reserve meaningful thought and agency to whites."
The November 8th New York Times report, "Ferguson waits uneasily for grand jury's decision," is off to a shaky start, with passive voice references to the time when riots and confrontations with the police shook this neighborhood, or when heavily fortified police officers faced the demonstrators and the nights sometimes turned violent. Nowadays, we're told, few are expecting peace in Ferguson due to the imminent decision that it's anticipated will fail to indict Officer Darren Wilson for the killing of Mike Brown. Readers read about windows being blocked up, business owners carrying guns, and school leaders reportedly asking that the announcement come on a Sunday, quote, so that children returning home are not caught in a melee, close quote. Well, as Labor editor Peter Hugness noted, the story's allocation of almost all of its empathy to fearful white people rests on sourcing, in which virtually every named person is white and not a single protester is interviewed. Though you did get Ferguson Mayor James Knowles warning that, quote, by 8-9 o'clock, nothing good is going to happen out on the streets. When the gremlins come out, you're just going to get caught in the crossfire, close quote. The effect is to stoke fears of protesters, despite a largely nonviolent record, as a source of looming menace and chaos. And as Hugness adds, quote, the less the public is perceived as sympathetic to or even interested in the concerns, emotions, and values of those protesting the killing of Mike Brown, the more the police will feel they have a free hand to respond violently to protest or disorder, close quote. Sadly, the tone-deaf piece fits in with the Times' recent reporting, which includes an October 31st piece on threats faced by law enforcement that referred to, quote, frustration from years of racial profiling and harassment, perceived and real, close quote, and included beleaguered police chief Thomas Jackson's claim that police just don't get a fair shake. There's only one narrative out there, Jackson says. These days, Times readers are ingenuously told, quote, Ferguson police officers say that they live as though someone out there intends to do them harm, close quote.
CBS Face the Nation host Bob Schieffer got Barack Obama and George W. Bush on the same broadcast on November 9th. During his chat with Bush, who is a friend off camera, Schieffer and the former president look back at the Iraq War, which is a chance for Bush to make one more false claim about that war he started. The two were still surprised all these years later that Saddam Hussein did not take Bush up on his offer to leave the country and avoid war. He didn't leave, of course, and thus, said Bush, Saddam Hussein chose war. In a preview of that Face the Nation interview, CBS Evening News anchor Scott Pelley told viewers that Bush, quote, ordered an invasion of Iraq after Saddam Hussein defied an ultimatum to give up power, close quote. If you remember the run-up to the war, Bush's ultimatum was indeed very dramatic. It was also not what it appeared. As Fair noted at the time, the New York Times had the story right on March 18, 2003, under the headline, Allies Will Move In Even If Saddam Hussein Moves Out. The paper noted that the U.S. military plan was to invade no matter what. Quote, even if Mr. Hussein were to be ousted in a sudden coup, a military intervention seems very likely. The question no longer seems to be whether American and British troops will enter Iraq, but under what circumstances, close quote. In the CBS interview, Bush says, when you say something as president, you better mean it. Evidently, CBS couldn't bother to point out that what he was saying was false.
Well, sometimes corporate media's elite bias shows through between the lines, if you will. Take this exchange between PBS NewsHour anchor Gwen Ifill and correspondent Margaret Warner, running down the issues the day after the midterm elections. Ifill refers to the hot spot of Iran, where she says there's been long ongoing discussion about sanctions. Warner responds that November 24th is, quote, the deadline to come up with a deal that would restrict Iran's nuclear program, persuade the world it wasn't going to get weapons in return for lifting sanctions, close quote. But Iran doesn't need to persuade the world. There's not a disagreement between Iran and the world. A small number of countries, the United States being the most powerful one, have made a variety of claims for the past several years about Iran possibly concealing a weapons program. There's no public evidence to support the most extreme accusation, but it doesn't seem to matter. Iran is under stiff sanctions, and U.S. lawmakers want to hit them even harder. The actual world, if you think the word means most of the people living on the planet, or at least the governments that represent them, has a very different view of the nuclear negotiations. The Non-Aligned Movement, an organization representing 120 countries and more than half the world's population, has consistently backed Iran's right to enrich uranium for a civilian nuclear program. You might say that defines the elite worldview. The world is how we view it.
And finally, a new assessment from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change sounded the usual alarms about the climate crisis, which meant it got at best passing coverage on TV news. ABC World News, for example, noted that we could soon be on an irreversible course. The right-wing Fox News Channel also told its viewers about the new IPCC report, but you might not be surprised to hear they did it their way. During a news break during Maria Bartiromo's Sunday Morning Futures show, Eric Shawn told viewers that the scientific panel says radical changes are necessary to turn things around. And then, of course, he just had to add this.
Critics, of course, have said that climate change, though, is largely not man-made.
That's right. In a report that is all of 70 words, Fox still felt the need to throw in a reference to climate change denial. That's the fair and balanced way.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The mainstream media consensus is that the consolidation of Republican power in Congress will provide momentum on issues where the White House and Republicans largely agree, and that one of these is trade policy. In particular, the Mammoth Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, the Associated Press told readers, could lead to rare consensus with congressional Republicans. Well, underneath the suggestion that we'll see bipartisan effort to pass TPP, of course, is the implication that that's good news. Lori Wallach is director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch and author of, most recently, The Rise and Fall of Fast Track Trade Authority. She joins us now by phone from D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Lori Wallach.
Thank you.
Well, that AP piece refers to the stubborn log jams that have held up an agreement on a trans-Pacific trade deal. Part of those log jams in this country are the fact that it's understood that to pass it, the president needs fast-track authority. Is fast-track what you see as the weak spot in this whole idea that we're going to see a combination of media's favorite things, so-called free trade and bipartisanship?
Well, I think that the media has overplayed the likelihood that the Obama trade agenda, which is also the corporate trade agenda, which is some of the Republicans' trade agenda, is going to have an easy time in this Congress. It is the case that the Obama administration has gotten to that place in the negotiations of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, where they're starting to get to a mindset to make any deal just so Obama gets credit for it. And they are abandoning a lot of the positions that they have held to through all the years of the negotiation, including some that are important and good for most of us, some that are bad that they should abandon. However, the likelihood is that they're really pushing for an agreement on TPP in the next 6 months, and they just missed another big deadline, so the window's closing on them, which gets us to this fast-track business. Fast-track doesn't just guarantee that the agreement gets an actual yes or no vote in 90 days with limited debate and no amendments. It also let the president sign and enter into an agreement like TPP before Congress approves it. And so part of what President Obama is trying to get Congress to do is more or less give him a blank check. That would be bad news, but actually, there's an interesting transpartisan antipathy to fast track that could end up saving us all on TPP.
Well, it's hard to picture these Republicans wanting to give that kind of authority to Barack Obama, of all people, who, you know, they've been pretty clear that they think he has too much power just being president.
Well, that is the hitch, because literally there are right now 6 Democratic votes in the House of Representatives in favor of the old fast track, which does not help the Republicans, given they've got a chunk of their members who, either because of what you said, they don't want to give Obama more power, or some of the strict constructionist constitutionalists think the delegation just not constitutional. They don't want to delegate that authority.
Well, for elite media, an idea that both the two dominant parties and corporate executives agree on is an idea that's beyond rational challenge. But on TPP, as on other issues, masses of the public seem to feel differently. So just to be clear, fear of the Trans-Pacific Partnership is not craziness or ignorance, is it?
Well, what's very interesting is when you talk about bipartisan consensus on trade, there is precisely what you said, an elite consensus of Democratic and Republican elite, although interestingly, a lot of the senior Democrat congressional leaders are against it, but President Obama for it, and Boehner for it, and McConnell for it, and Wall Street and corporate America and the Chamber of Commerce, K Street lobbyists for it. But the polling actually shows that there is a majority of Americans, Democrats, independents, and Republicans, who don't want any more of our old style of trade agreements. The more they hear about TPP in particular and the countries with which they as workers would have to be competing in the 14 cents an hour wages in Vietnam, et cetera, the less they like the idea. And so, interestingly, if we can force a public debate as compared to a quiet, secretive one, or a no debate, and we can make this fight about who gets to decide the future of the policies in our country, is it going to be Congress and the checks and balances in the Constitution, or is it going to be authority chucked away just to whomever is president, because this would be 8 years of this extraordinary authority? That's a fight we can win.
We've talked about how, even though they're called trade pacts, very little of these documents address actual trade. They involve handing over a lot of power to corporations vis-a-vis the public. And it sort of seems that if media would keep corporations at the center of the story as constructors, as actors in making the TPP, rather than presenting them as kind of one of several sectors that will be affected by whatever happens, it seems like that would help people understand the nature of this pact maybe a little more clearly. What do you think?
I think that's right. And frankly, I almost needed CPR when the Washington Post finally 6 months ago did an infographic and a story on the 600 official corporate trade advisors who have dictated these policies with the 15 unions and two environmental groups mixed in. I think also for the mainstream press, the way into the story is basically all the different ways that aren't about trade, that they're already covering, that aren't taboo for them to cover, that damage would be done to, such as a lot of coverage on, for instance, financial re-regulation, except part of TPP would roll back those improvements and would explicitly forbid the use of speculation taxes or capital controls to avoid financial crises, or a lot of coverage on the tax incentives that promote offshoring of jobs, except the TPP includes an entire provision chapter, lots of provisions that actually incentivize offshoring by effectively lowering the risk premium, getting rid of the potential threats or costs for offshoring. Or the mainstream media is constantly covering food safety issues, except the TPP would roll back some of the big improvements with the Food Safety Modernization Act passed a couple years ago with respect to us having to take imported food that doesn't meet our safety standards. Or there's been a considerable amount of coverage about medicine prices, except in several different chapters, TPP's provisions would basically give new monopolies to the big pharmaceutical companies and let them jack up medicine prices and take away a lot of policy tools. Not just the Obama administration, but governments in these other countries have used to try and contain healthcare costs. And then there's the sneaky aspects of the copyright provisions of TPP that would sneak through sort of pieces of ACTA, the anti-counterfeiting treaty, or SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, the stuff that undermines internet freedom that has to do with, for instance, internet service provider liability for what you do as a user when you're not, you know, you're not doing commercial large-scale copyright violations. You pay a dollar for a recipe, and then I send it to you after you've had dinner at my house because you asked me for it, and that's a violation. Am I going to get knocked off? Are they allowed to spy on me about that? So all of these non-trade policy threats are contained in TPP, and that's the way that the mainstream media ought to be covering the story.
We've been speaking with Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Find them online at tradewatch.org. Thank you very much, Lori Wallach, for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
The obvious headline from the 2014 midterms was the Republican wave that swept across the country. They won races in what were even considered to be blue states. The other headline, voter turnout was low, even by low midterm standards. That left some people wondering, did the Republican-led efforts to limit the vote play a role in all of this? We're joined now by a reporter who has been on this story for months. Ari Berman is a contributing writer for The Nation magazine, and he's an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. Welcome to the show, Ari Berman.
Thank you, Peter.
Now, the lay of the land here is pretty bleak, and you've written about this for months. In the run-up to the 2012 elections, we saw almost 200 new restrictions on the vote. And then, of course, the Supreme Court in 2013, there was a decision on the Voting Rights Act. So 2014, the midterms that just passed, were in some ways a test for how these laws were going to play out in the real world. What can we say we know about the laws' real-world impact in the 2014 elections?
Well, I think we can say that the laws had a real-world impact, first off. I mean, we saw that this was the first election without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act in nearly 50 years. Voters in 14 states faced new restrictions on the books. We know there were stories of people who couldn't vote as a result of those restrictions. For example, in Texas, people were turned away who had voted for many years because of their voter ID law, because they didn't have specific forms of photo ID that were now required by Texas for the first time to vote. We know in North Carolina, which is a state that eliminated voting reforms like same-day voter registration, like being able to cast a ballot if you accidentally showed up at the wrong precinct, that people were turned away as a result of this. We know that in states like North Carolina where they cut early voting, there were longer lines as a result. And we know there was a lot of confusion in the run-up to the election in other states that had changed their voting rules. And so I do think there was a real-world impact. Even if it didn't swing the election, it certainly had an impact.
I know in one of the pieces that you wrote, you noted that the Election Protection Coalition had a phone number where people could call if they had problems, and they saw a pretty remarkable jump over the previous midterm, right?
Yeah, they saw a 40% increase in problems, which I think is significant. And there's always problems on election day. People don't know where their polling place is. They don't know if they're registered to vote, things like that. And then you add on all these new restrictions. And so I was at two call centers that were monitoring voting problems all across the country, including in some of these problematic states like Texas. And there was all these run-of-the-mill problems, and then there was new problems. And you're trying to figure out, are these just standard election administration issues, or are these a result of laws that are meant to keep people from voting? And it's hard to disentangle the two. But what we know is that an election system that's already pretty poorly constructed in the U.S., where every state has different rules and sometimes they're interpreted differently by every single poll worker, now we have all these new restrictions added on top of that. And I think that's why we have such low turnout, because we're passing laws that are making it harder to vote rather than encouraging people to vote. And people are being turned away. People are being forced to cast provisional ballots, which is a last resort. You know, we don't know sometimes for months or years, even after the election, what exactly happened.
Now, there is one curious angle on this issue that tries to argue that if you complain about the difficulty of voting, but then that motivates more people to turn out to vote, you've kind of debunked your own case. Morning Edition, the NPR show, had a piece about this, and it ran with this web headline, "Activists Against Voter Restrictions May Be Hindering Their Legal Case." How do you respond to this idea that actually, the new laws only serve to motivate people, and that's sort of ironically a good thing?
Well, number one, that's not why the laws are being passed. So the laws aren't being passed to encourage a voter backlash, or else they wouldn't be passing them in the first place, because the people that are passing the laws are trying to prohibit certain people from voting, or trying to make it harder for them to participate. The second thing is, even if there is a backlash like there was, for example, in 2012 in states like Ohio, that doesn't mean that it's not wrong to make it harder to vote. And I would add a third thing, which is, even if these laws don't swing the election, because in a lot of states the election wasn't as close as we thought it might be because there was such a Republican wave, that doesn't mean that it's not wrong to send people away from voting. So, for example, in Texas, which is a state where, you know, the Republican candidate for governor, Greg Abbott, trounced the Democratic candidate for governor, Wendy Davis, which I think overshadowed some of the stories of people who were turned away from voting who may have been more likely to vote for the Democrats. So the voter ID law didn't get as much attention, but people were still turned away from voting. So I think a lot of the media have been so fixated on the Republican wave that they've ignored these stories of disenfranchisement, and they'll only cover them if we have a Florida 2000 situation where the election is within 500 votes. And I think that's a problematic frame, that disenfranchisement only matters if it decides the outcome of the election. I mean, disenfranchisement is wrong no matter when and how it occurs.
You mentioned the Texas election, which was a blowout in a way that I think a lot of people didn't predict. But there were some races, particularly in North Carolina, where people were looking at the new law and wondering if this was enough to swing the election. It's impossible to know that, but what are people pointing to in a state like North Carolina right now?
It's very difficult to know what decides an election. What we do know is that Republican Tom Tillis defeated Democrat Kay Hagan by 48,000 votes in the race for the Senate. North Carolina did a number of things that cut back on voter participation. They cut early voting by a week, which 200,000 people used in 2010. They eliminated same-day registration, which 20,000 people used in 2010. And they eliminated out-of-precinct voting, which 7,000 people used in 2010. So that's five times the margin of victory. Now, I'm not suggesting that all those people weren't able to vote, because in fact, early voting was up. because there was a highly contested Senate race. And so some could argue that maybe the law didn't have as much impact. I know, based on my own reporting, people were turned away from the polls in North Carolina. I don't know if 48,000 voters were turned away in the polls. My guess is they weren't. But I do know that people were turned away from the polls. I also know there were longer lines at the polls. There were longer lines at the polls because there were shorter days in which to vote early, so there were it was a compressed schedule. You were putting more voters into a shortened early voting period, which led to longer lines in early voting and longer lines on Election Day. North Carolina also eliminated straight ticket voting, so you had a very long ballot, so people couldn't go in and mark their ballot anymore for one party. They had to vote for each individual race. There was a lot of contested races. That led to longer lines. So I don't necessarily think that 48,000 people were turned away because of long lines or because of the elimination of some of these early voting reforms, but it goes to show you that if this election had been even closer, if it had been, let's say, 10,000 votes, which is, you know, the Obama won North Carolina by 17,000 votes or something like that in 2008. If it had been that close, I think we could start looking and saying, yes, maybe this did decide the election.
Now, finally, people can argue about whether the laws are consequential, but the fact remains that Republican lawmakers are looking to pass more voting restrictions like they've passed already. What do their future plans look like as we head toward 2016?
Well, we've already seen that Nevada, which is a state that's now controlled by the Republicans for the first time since 1929, they're already writing a voter ID bill there. It's been said that it's a top priority for the GOP in the state. And so one of the consequences of passing these new voting restrictions is number one, new states are going to pass them, like Nevada. Number two, states that have already passed them are going to pass tougher restrictions. So these voter ID laws are going to get stricter and stricter. There's going to be new restrictions that are sent down, and basically people now feel emboldened that they can get away with doing this, that it's harder to block them in court now since the Voting Rights Act has been gutted. And I think some Republicans feel like they got away with this. They got exactly what they wanted. The electorate was older, wider and more conservative than in 2008 or 2012. Turnout was lower and Republicans won. So I think we have definitive proof now that when the electorate is smaller, Republicans benefit. They're going to try to replicate that going forward.
We've been speaking with Ari Berman. He's an investigative journalism fellow at the Nation Institute. You can read his work on voting rights at thenation.com. Ari Berman, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Peter.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.